Live from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Fresh Air is one of the exhibits at the museum today. We're broadcasting from their new radio studio, so everything will be a little bit different than usual. Our theme music sounds different because the composer Joel Forrester is playing it live. Here in New York, one of the hottest tickets on Broadway is Jelly's Last Jam, a musical about Jelly Roll Morton. We'll meet the show's writer and director, George C. Wolfe. And jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli will perform. He's so versatile, he's recorded with Benny Goodman, Zoot Sims, and Dion and the Belmonts. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, we have the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Protesters poured into Baghdad today to demonstrate against the UN inspection of a government building where documents on Iraq's weapons program were thought to be stored. The official heading the UN Commission to Disarm Iraq said the protests would not stop the search of the building, but Rolf Ekeas acknowledged that Iraq has had ample opportunity to get rid of the documents. The BBC's Simon Ingram reports.
As the six-man inspection team went about its work inside the Ministry of Agriculture building, Iraqi security forces sealed off the area around the compound. The move denied Western journalists the chance to observe the operation, but appeared aimed rather at preventing large crowds of protesters from marching on the building. The demonstrators, said to number tens of thousands, assembled in response to calls in the state-controlled media for people to display their support for President Saddam Hussein and their disdain for the representatives of the United Nations. Two main bridges in Baghdad were closed to traffic as the crowd headed towards the city center, chanting, "President Bush, take care. We all love Saddam Hussein."
Simon Ingram reporting from Cairo. Israel's new prime minister acknowledged today that legal and financial constraints would prevent him from stopping construction on thousands of housing units for Jewish settlers in the occupied territories. New figures from the Israeli government show that 9,500 new houses will be completed. That's nearly all the units that are currently under construction. It's not clear what impact the announcements would have on $10 billion in U.S. loan guarantees for Israel. According to the Associated Press, three Democratic congressmen who said they'd refuse to testify about the House post office have had their appearances before a grand jury postponed. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Democrats Dan Rostenkowski of Illinois, Austin Murphy, and Joseph Coulter of Pennsylvania have called the investigation into the House post office a political witch hunt. Last week, they said they would claim their Fifth Amendment rights and refuse to testify before a grand jury. The former postmaster of the House facility, Robert Rota, resigned under pressure after reports of mismanagement were made public. Already, several postal employees have been convicted of embezzlement and drug dealing. According to some reports, one House post office employee has charged that Rostenkowski improperly exchanged stamps for cash. Last week, a House report on the post office quoted the same employee saying he was not aware of any such scheme. According to the Wire report, lawyers for the three congressmen are negotiating with prosecutors from the U.S. Attorney's Office about whether they will be forced to appear before the grand jury at a later date. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 52 points to close at 3,334. Advances led declines by a margin of more than 3-1. This is NPR. The Washington Post quoted sources today who say that former Democratic presidential adviser Clark Clifford is expected to be indicted tomorrow on charges of bank fraud. The potential indictment against Clifford, his law associate Robert Altman, and several others stems from their involvement with the secret takeover of their Washington-based bank. Their bank, First American, was taken over by the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, the Arab-owned bank that collapsed last year amid widespread charges of wrongdoing. A federal investigation centered on allegations that Clifford and Altman lied to bank regulators in 1982 when they said that BCCI had no ownership in First American. A former New York congressman convicted in the WedTech scandal has announced his candidacy for his old seat. For member station WNYC, Don Matheson reports.
Convicted felon Mario Biaggi has entered the Democratic congressional primary, hoping to represent the Bronx and Westchester County. The 74-year-old politician was convicted of multiple felonies and sentenced to 8 years in federal prison. He was released about a year ago because he was in poor health after serving 2 years behind bars. Biagi formally entered the primary while addressing supporters from the back of a truck.
I am a free man anxious to return as a contributing member of society. I always believed that that was an inalienable right of individuals who paid their debt.
Biagi hasn't completely paid his debt to society. He still owes $500,000 in fines. For National Public Radio, I'm Don Matheson in New York.
Chrysler Corporation announced second quarter earnings today that far exceeded expectations on Wall Street. The nation's number three automaker said it earned $178 million in the period from April through June. That amounted to 54 cents a share, up more than 19% from the same period a year ago. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, and we're live from the broadcast studio of the Museum of Television and Radio, which is filled with people who've come to watch the show. In a moment, we'll meet George C. Wolfe, the writer and director of the Broadway musical Jelly's Last Jam, about Jelly Roll Morton. Morton was one of the first great jazz pianists and is considered the first jazz composer. To get in the mood, a little music. The composer of Fresh Air's theme, Joel Forrester, is with us. And Joel, it's a great treat to have you here in person.
Wonderful to be here.
And I know that Jelly Roll Morton has been an important influence on your own composing, so maybe you can play us an example of how.
I'd love to. This is just a little line of Morton's that I fill edited out of his beautiful piece, Perfect Drag.
How does that relate to your own composition?
Well, let's see. I think I copped two elements from Morton going into this tune, Ruddock in the Ring. One is his what he called the Spanish tinge, and the other is a certain celestial chord change. And that last tune, you know, it went from here to here. And this tune of mine goes from here to here. It's like this.
That's a great piece.
Oh, thanks.
And Joel Forrester will be with us throughout the show today. Now, Jelly Roll Morton's music is being reinterpreted in the new Broadway musical Jelly's Last Jam. Gregory Hines plays Jelly Roll Morton. The show is written and directed by my guest, George C. Wolfe. New York Times theater critic Frank Rich described Wolfe as a visionary talent who has given Jelly's Last Jam ambitions beyond the imagination of most Broadway musicals. Rich said it's a show in part about what it means to be African-American and is itself an attempt to remake the Broadway musical in a mythic African-American image. Wolfe also wrote and directed The Colored Museum, a series of vignettes that satirized, among other things, black musicals. George C. Wolfe, welcome to
Thank you. Fresh Air.
And what does Jelly Roll Morton's music mean to you?
Well, I think what I find, when I first began working on the show, I knew it only briefly. And then once I started getting into the character and really starting to research the period, you realize how much of the attitude and the energy and the arrogance of a people is found in the music of the composer. And I think one of the things which is endlessly fascinating to me, that the first generation of free black Americans created the one indigenous American art form called jazz. So it's like all that energy that was restrained, all of a sudden it was released and it came forth with this extraordinary art form. So what I think that I'm a musician, but I'm really not a musician. I'm more drawn to the emotional qualities and sort of the storytelling that is buried inside of the music. So that's the more I started listening to the music, the more I realized all kinds of little secrets and stories are buried inside of that music. And the dynamic that exists in this country that oftentimes, which is, I think, true of any country, that oftentimes people without power, their stories are not told. It's only in the songs of the day where their stories live. And I think that's very true of the blues. And I think it's especially true of Jelly's music.
One of the themes in your show about Jelly Roll Morton, who was a Creole, was that because of his lighter skin, he kind of treated darker-skinned African-Americans with a kind of racist attitude.
And at the same time claiming to have single-handedly invented jazz. So there's a line that say, he who drinks from the vine of syncopation but denies the black soil from which that rhythm was born. That was the thing which I found tremendously compelling, that I did this, but at the same time I'm not a part of these people who actually were a part of the creation of the thing that I claim to have single-handedly done.
What spoke to you about this theme of what you were talking about, and also of a lighter-skinned person looking down on darker-skinned people?
Well, I don't think it's just exclusively a lighter-skinned person. I just think it's anyone... There is a dynamic that once you become a racist, there is not only is it at expense to the people who you mistreat, but there's a loss of humanity with yourself as well. So that was interesting in exploring the dynamic that when you close yourself off to a whole group of people because of how they look or what they are, you're also closing yourself off to certain truths about yourself. And at the same time, he was very blessed to have been a brilliant man. So that therefore, I was just intrigued by that dynamic between, here's this person who's capable of creating music that celebrates the culture that he says he has no connection with. And I found that contradiction just incredibly human and very fascinating.
In your show, The Colored Museum, one of the things you satirized was black musicals. And, you know, one of the characters says, I wish my son were born into a black musical. Nobody dies in a black musical. What was it about black musicals that kind of... got to you in a negative way, and what do you think you've tried to do differently?
Well, it's this thing which I call a cultural strip mining, whereas fundamentally you don't go through the dirt to get the gem. You just sort of scoop down, get the gem, and you put it on top. And so you strip away any of the texture and the reality that informs the energy and the attitude of the music. It was like if you were to do Hamlet, and all of a sudden the lights would come up and Hamlet would be there saying, to be or not to be, and you go, why is he saying that? It's almost the same. It's almost that same feeling with music. You have a black singer on stage moaning and wailing. You go, what is that about? What is that about? If you then can show how the dynamics of that person's personal life and the dynamics of their world inform the moment, it seems to me a much more fulfilling journey. But prior to that time, most of the musicals that were about composers, in particular, UBA Misbehaving, whereas they were done to varying degrees of quality, always stripped away the textures of the human being and, in many respects, of African-American culture, and just left the energy and the joy and the bounce. So you're getting sort of Kool-Aid without any real substance going on.
I want to get back to that line that nobody dies in an all-black musical. Is that why we start with Jelly Roll Morton's death?
Everybody in Jelly is dead because
right.
It's a memory. So we solved that right there. Yeah, I was just very fascinated by the prospect of that in death, in that moment, just before or just after death, is there does clarity exist?
Yeah.
Are you aware? Are you able to see how you fit into the scheme of things? Are you able to see the stupid mistakes that you made along the way? Are you able to understand yourself in a whole other way? And if that were the case, how do you forgive yourself? So that you can then move on.
It must be kind of exciting and frustrating at the same time to have a Broadway show about the kinds of issues that you're addressing in Jelly's Last Jam. Because here you are trying to address like important African-American issues, and you're doing it on the Broadway stage where tickets are really, really expensive.
Precisely, yeah.
I mean, like the cheapest seat is around $45.
Exactly.
And so it's really kind of very limiting in terms of who can actually come and see this. And the day I saw it, I mean, the audience was predominantly white and pretty well heeled,
But I must say also that at the same time that I think that up to this, given that dynamic, we have had the largest percentages of black audiences
Broadway
since.
Yeah.
It's a problem because when art is expensive, who can go see it?
Yeah, exactly.
And it is sort of, it's a double-edged thing. At the same time, you're out there and you're helping to shape and redefine the structure of a community that is in many respects functions off of an archaic energy, but at the same time, who is coming to see it?
So it's a peculiar reality
that I don't know.
So tell me, before the show opened, were you in the doctor's office with peculiar nervous maladies?
Well, no, it was just no. I was kind of like, oh, okay, I'm on Broadway now, and to me, I couldn't be overwhelmed by any of that because the ambitions of the musicals were such that it required every single inch of brain that I had left. So there was really no time to be neurotic. I mean, there was just sort of like, it's a massive show, and it's a very ambitious show. So that
So they all, and there was a month of previews, and this doesn't work, fix it, and there was all this energy. I mean, I had strangers writing me saying things like, don't let your ego destroy the show, and I go, I've never met you, lady, how do you know this about me? So it was, so all of a sudden, it's sort of like you're having open heart surgery and right. in a stadium, and everybody's saying, go, fail, and it'd be sort of like, and you're performing this intricate surgery on yourself, almost.
Well, how do you feel when you... Do you sing or dance or anything? Do you
no.
have any gifts in those? How do you
no.
feel when you're around a lot of really talented people who sing and dance really well? Do you feel physically self-conscious?
No, not at all. Because, I mean, the thing which is what... I have a vocabulary of movement. I don't have a vocabulary vocally at all, as anyone will tell you. But I have a vocabulary of movement. And what you do, I... You know, because... Style is very important to me, and the thing which I think which so that therefore I'm able to take the show to a certain level, and then there's a choreographer, Hope Clark, who takes it to that next level, so that therefore it appears
right.
seamless, and
right.
there's a fluidity and an elegance to the visuals of the show that makes it as appealing even when the subject matter is getting very dark. There's always this visual seduction going on as well.
George C. Wolfe is my guest, the writer and director of Jilly's Last Jam, which is on Broadway. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. With George C. Wolfe, writer and director of Jilly's Last Jam, a Broadway musical about Jelly Roll Morton. I want to find out a little bit about you. I know your mother was a principal,
mm-hmm.
and I believe a private school.
A private black grade school in Kentucky, Frankfort, Kentucky, that I went to.
I think
she wasn't a principal when I went there, thank God. But.
Oh, yeah, that's what I wanted to know. I can't imagine, you know, having a mother who's a principal, an authority figure like that in your own home.
I know. I didn't know what to call her when she was around, because she was teaching there, you know. I don't know what I would call her.
Mrs. Mom.
Hey, you know, so we'll see.
And your father was in the Department of Corrections. Was he a corrections officer?
No, he was just sort of like part of a... system that I think did nothing, so but he was paid to do so.
So he was more a bureaucrat than
yes.
a prison guard or
yes.
something. Yeah, because I can imagine
yes.
having like a mother as a principal and a father as a prison guard.
Exactly.
It's like,
whoa. You know. We lived in Sing Sing, you know, so like, yeah.
It was in Sing Sing?
No, I'm not.
Oh.
But I'm both.
You actually grew up in Kentucky,
yes,
right?
I did, yes.
Yeah, so you grew up in a black neighborhood, but yeah. ended up going to a white high school, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did you change neighborhoods or
No, it's just neighborhoods? Because, I mean, it's very fascinating because I've recently been thinking about that world. And I realized it was a very fascinating thing because it was a very contained world. This was 1964, so there was the Capitol Theater, which I couldn't go to because they didn't allow black people to go to it. There was this where you couldn't do this. And all that started to change, but for the whole first 10 years of my life, my reality was fundamentally black. There were white people, but you went to white people to acquire things that did not exist in the black community, but there was no sense of this is the desired thing to be, because everything you desire to be is contained within your world, which I realized was really a wonderful thing to grow up into. And then all of a sudden, I'm in this other world, and therefore, because of the way I look, I was immediately ignored, whereas in my world, I was valued because I was viewed as being bright and wonderful. So I found that extraordinary dynamic where in one world, I'm prized, in another world, I don't exist. I have to prove that I am beyond this clump definition that people have for me. So it sets into motion a sort of a conquering energy or a defeatist energy, depending on what sort of substance you come from.
Big identity crisis when you got to this white high school?
Not at all, no. It was just sort of, I mean, identity crisis because it's 13, 14 and your hormones are out of whack.
Yes.
So all that's going
right,
on.
Right.
And then, but then also to feel that sense, that know that people are looking at you and dismissing you and clumping you somewhere was a very fascinating thing to deal with, and I think it really did set into motion a machine. I didn't realize at the time, but a machine of arrogance and defiance, saying, "Oh, I will invade this room. I will invade this reality, and I will not be ignored." You know, I was at that time. I'm sure I was doing it from an energy of fear as opposed to absolute confidence. But I think that's in large part is where a certain level of my ambition took hold.
So how did that attitude get expressed in among your friends from the school or in the classroom?
Well, it was actually through theater because it really sort of traumatized me on a certain level because it took me about 2 or 3 years to sort of to figure out where I was and why I was there. Then my mother was away at school getting her doctorate, so I went to a theater program in Ohio. I'd always wanted to do theater before, but I would write. In my grade school, I did it, but in this school, I didn't bother to do it. So then I came back, and I started doing, you know, whatever plays, and I was funny. So then I sort of acquired a certain fame around high school, and then I sort of used, and I remember thinking, being about 15 or 16, by the time I leave here, I'm going to be president of this club, and this, and I'm going to be the drum major. I was this sort of ambition machine, simply because how dare you ignore me, you know, because of who I am. Who you perceive me to be. So I'm going back for my 20-year high school reunion, which is sort of horrifying. But
Yes,
I'm going back in August. It's going to be fun, you know. But it's really very fascinating because as much as I go around and experience things in the world, I realize so much of who I am is Frankfort, Kentucky.
Yeah.
Still, you know what I mean?
Yeah. You know. Remember that when you're on Broadway, right?
Oh, exactly. Well, all these people from my hometown have come to visit. So all of a sudden, those rhythms that I was no longer speak are coming back to me, and I'm going, "Oh my God!"
So this kind of like "do not ignore me" attitude. Did you have that when you started to pass your plays around and trying to get them produced?
Well, the thing which is what I would do is that out of college, I would get together with a group of friends and we would, let's go do this play. I never sort of like knocked on the door and said, hi, would you, I never was interested in doing that because somehow I didn't think I was going to, I think you can learn a lot more by failing inside of your own reality. And then at one point, once, particularly for a writer, once you have evolved your own vocabulary, but I think it's very dangerous to put yourself inside of a rigid structure before you have your own voice. Because if those structures are there, they are, and they've survived, they're successful, and they're successful because they've done it for one or two people. And generally most places that teach art in any way, shape, or form, you will find one or two people who really know how to allow individual voices to come through. But by and large, that's not the case. And I think that's true of theaters as well. In the beginning, they're receptive to new voices, but after a while, they get their formula together. So I was always drawn to those places that were probably financially shaky or the leadership wasn't as clear because I knew that I could set up a little niche in the corner flourish there. And yes, I was starving, but at least my work was happening. So it was, I think it was, I'm glad it turned out that way. And then coming to New York, then you confront the machine, but I was confronting the machine with my own voice evolve now, as opposed to confronting the machine and not knowing what the hell I was doing.
In your play, The Colored Museum, in addition to spoofing like black musicals, you spoof what you call the mama on a couch play, the domestic drama that tears at the very fabric of racist America. Did you get tired of that kind of social realist play? Well, did it start to sound like cliched to you?
Well, it wasn't so much. On a fundamental level, the reason I became a writer because I was a director is because I wanted to give myself something to direct that was more theatrical.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I.
What's the Mama on the Couch?
Well, the last Mama on the Couch play is the social realism. It is the fat mama on the couch who was worn and beaten down, and the son who's angry at the man, and mm-hmm. this, you know, and I want to be somebody. It's raising the son gone to the realm of bad, but Raising the Son, which is an extraordinary work, but after a while, beyond the valley of raising his son of raising of a son, you know, so it was sort of like, so I was interested in, but that wasn't interesting to me, was I was drawn to no theater, I was drawn to much more heightened styles of theater, and I was intrigued how you could take that somehow, that within black culture, you have blues, you have the jazz, you have all these music art forms that are larger than life, that have the emotional intensity of the human condition, but at the same time have an epic sort of energy to them. So I was interested in trying to come up with stage pictures that were reflective of that energy. And it couldn't, from my taste and my aesthetic, it couldn't be found contained in four walls and a beat-up couch. So that therefore I've always been drawn, besides I think movies and TV do realism so much better, you know, and that I think that theater is really a place about ideas. And so that therefore I was drawn to much more theatrical images and images that were, that's when I, like, when I did Spunk, it was...
This is based on Zora Neale Hurston's
stories. It was like a very stark space that in many respects was very Japanese in its nature, because somehow if you hang a line of wash across the back of it and put a goat in the front yard, it's somehow, oh, we know what that is. And once again, so we perceive it as being a stories about Southern Black people as opposed to stories about...
Individuals.
Well, not even individuals, but men and women and people in love and the loss of power and how you get back power. That somehow by stripping away all the collective cliches that we operate from, you begin to see the material anew and see the culture anew.
So I got a question for you. There's another show at the Public Theater by Anna Deavere Smith. It's a one-woman show about racial and ethnic identity. And she's interviewed a lot of people, and she recreates the people who she's interviewed. She plays like 26 mm-hmm. characters. One of those 26 characters is you, George C. Wolfe.
Yes.
I'm sure you've been to see the show. You actually helped get her show produced.
Yeah, I curated a festival of solo artists at the Public Theater in December, and she was one.
So what was it like, briefly, for you in the audience to watch Anna Deavere Smith doing you?
Well, I'm sort of used to it because every single person I work with does a bad version of me because I use my hands a lot and I talk and have a lot of energy. But hers was actually sort of, I'm reluctant to say, quite good. But it was sort of, I was going, the thing which was very funny, I saw her do it and I went, oh, this feels a little bit more correct, but her hands, she's moving her hands too much. My hands don't move like that. And then I saw something of a documentary where I was talking to the cast and my hands were flooding around like a hummingbird. I went, oh my God, it's true. This is horrifying. All those things that people have been saying about me are true. My hands do fly all over the place and I do talk a mile a minute. Oh my God. It was fun. But I remember having the conversation with her, but I don't. So it was sort of like, oh, that's how I talk?
Right. So very briefly, you only have a couple of seconds. How often do you go to Broadway now to see your show?
I pop in, try very infrequently. When it first opened up, I was around it a bit more. But
what do you look for now when you go?
I look to see whether or not anybody has killed anybody backstage.
I hope not.
Because they are flawlessly brilliant on stage.
Right.
It's an extraordinary cast. So right. I know they're... I'm very proud of that.
Well, it's been great to have you here, George C. Wolfe. I thank you very much
thank you.
For being with us. And George C. Wolfe is the writer and director of Jelly's Last Jam, which is now playing on Broadway. It's a musical about Jelly Roll Morton. And I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air, and we're live today from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. And one of the people with us today is Joel Forrester, the co-founder of the Microscopic Septet and the composer of the Fresh Air theme, which I must say I'm always asked about wherever I go. So it's a delight to have Joel here today. Joel, let me ask you to play us out.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Live from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a different kind of guitar hero. The great Bucky Pizzarelli will perform for us. He's keeping alive the dying art of rhythm guitar and the styles of the early jazz guitar masters. Meanwhile, taking some liberties with our theme music is the composer himself, Joel Forrester. Take it, Joel.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Members of a UN inspection team were allowed into a government building in Baghdad today, 3 weeks later than planned. A UN official says the team's work is not finished and that inspectors will be back tomorrow. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Speaking to reporters, team leader Akeem Bierman gave no hint of what, if anything, the inspectors had found in the building. He did say there's still work to be done. The UN's attempt to get into the building touched off a major standoff with Baghdad that led allied officials to talk about launching another military strike against Iraq. The dispute was settled Sunday after the UN agreed that no inspectors from the United States or any of its Gulf War allies would go into the ministry. UN officials say they expect that Iraq cleared many of the most incriminating documents from the building, but they're pushing ahead with the inspections anyway. As the inspectors worked today, long columns of Iraqi demonstrators marched through Baghdad, denouncing the UN and President Bush. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
Pentagon officials say that plans have changed and a third U.S. aircraft carrier will not be sent to the Persian Gulf. Citing an easing in tension between the U.S. and Iraq, officials say the Pentagon has canceled plans to send the USS Kennedy to the Middle East, and the ship is now engaged in normal exercises in the Western Atlantic. Yesterday, the government said that the U.S. air carrier and more Patriot missiles were being sent to the Persian Gulf area. According to officials at the State Department, the new government of Israel has agreed to hold the next round of Middle Eastern peace talks in Washington. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Under Prime Minister Shamir, Israel tried to hold the next round in the Middle East. That would suggest Arab recognition of the State of Israel. Arab leaders refused. They preferred Washington, and Rome was chosen as a compromise. But under Prime Minister Rabin, the Israeli government has changed course. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher.
Our understanding is that they wanted to be in Washington, as the other parties did, because the urgency of getting the next round going and because of their desire to be in close touch with the co-sponsors.
The U.S. and Russia are co-sponsoring the talks. Boucher said the negotiations are expected to resume in the latter half of August, and he said there's a distinct possibility that they will then be continuous without the periodic interruptions that we've had in the past. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
In Paris, two underground trains collided during evening rush hour, and officials say more than 30 people were injured. One train was apparently entering Paris when it hit a train in front of it. The train should have been 2.5 minutes apart. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 52 points to close at 3,334.07 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Former President Jimmy Carter joined Democrats in criticizing the Bush administration's foreign policy efforts today, as Carter charged it will be a travesty as Secretary of State James Baker leaves his post to lead the Republican reelection campaign. Vice presidential candidate Al Gore, appearing in Atlanta with Carter, accused the Bush administration of centering on foreign policy at the expense of concerns at home. Gore also said if President Bush and Vice President Quayle are such whizzes at foreign policy, why is it that Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein is thumbing his nose at the entire world? Bill Clinton continued his campaigning today, flying from San Francisco to Illinois, where he spoke on the lawn of a suburban hospital. NPR's Ira Glass reports.
Just one day after President Bush started emphasizing the theme of trust, Bill Clinton responded, saying that voters could only trust that the president would continue his failed policies if reelected. He also criticized the president's handling of Saddam Hussein. Clinton had a mediocre turnout at a rally at the LaGrange Memorial Hospital, where he pledged to increase research funding for women's health concerns, including breast cancer.
There is a vast inequity in our country in the research that has been done and the way it's been done on health issues. And women have had their particular concerns grossly underfunded.
Asked about the French abortion pill RU486, Clinton said the Food and Drug Administration should review it again without political considerations. I'm Ira Glass in Chicago.
President Bush's reelection advertising campaign is to get underway Monday. The Associated Press is reporting that the $7 million blitz appears to be concentrated on local television station in states that are considered key to the fall election. The AP says the campaign will spend about $125,000 on cable news network. In trading today in Europe, the dollar was down. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, and we're live from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York with a studio audience. Now, it's my great pleasure to introduce the great guitarist, Bucky Pizzarelli. When you listen to him, it's like listening to a history of jazz guitar. He's played with some of the same musicians his guitar predecessors have, musicians like Benny Goodman, Joe Venuti, and Stefan Grappelli. And in the days when there was a lot of studio work for jazz musicians, he was one of the most sought-after ones. So he has quite a varied resume. He was a member of the Tonight Show Orchestra when they broadcast out of New York, and he's recorded with everyone from Dion and the Belmonts to Ray Charles. But he doesn't need to play with anyone to sound great. He's wonderful solo, as you can hear on his new album, Bucky Pizzarelli, A Portrait on Stash Records, and as you're about to hear now. Welcome, Bucky Pizzarelli.
Thank you.
And let's get started with a tune, and then you're going to play all kinds of things for us, kind of harkening back to the history of jazz. But why don't we start with a ballad?
I'd like to do a number written by Ray Noble called The Very Thought of You.
Great. I should mention, your guitar is not the kind of standard guitar. It's a seven, not a six-string guitar.
It's a seven-string guitar developed by George Van Epps, who lives in California at the moment.
So what do you do with the seventh string?
Well, it's good for accompanying. If I'm playing with another guitarist or a singer, I'm doing this. That gives me a bass. It's like a bass and a guitar playing together. Without the seventh string, it would just sound... So it gives it that low note.
That's nice, yeah. Speaking of which, you are one of the great rhythm guitar players. For our listeners who don't know what we mean when we say rhythm guitar, play a little bit of rhythm guitar and show us.
Well, rhythm guitar is the very most important thing in playing the guitar. If I advise anybody that wants to play guitar to learn how to play the chords first. That's how I learned. You know, in the old days of Gene Autry on the radio, he was doing. But it's very important to know the chords. You know, it's funny, but it's important. A lot of young guitarists start playing solos and they forget about playing chords. And I'll show you. I'll give you an example how Freddie Green, probably the greatest rhythm guitar player with the Count Basie Orchestra, played rhythm. And if you listen to any of the old Count Basie bands, the most predominant thing of the band and the sound of the band is the rhythm guitar. And he's only playing a few notes in a chord, not a full chord. He's not doing that. He's playing.
What's the hardest thing about playing rhythm guitar?
Well, getting a beat out of it. You become a drummer.
Right.
At one spot, and if you don't come down after the bass player plays the downbeat, you're playing the second and fourth beats of the bar of music. And it's that commitment. If it's a slow, the slower the song is, the harder it is, and you better be right when you come down with it.
We've got a lot more to play for us, but first we're going to have to take a short break. Then we'll be back with jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli performing live for us today on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. With jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli. Well, you told us a little bit about Freddie Green and the influence he had on you. Let's talk about some of the other kind of historical styles and the players who created them that have influenced you. How about Django Reinhardt, who...
Django, yes, was in a group in Paris with Stefan Grappelli, a jazz violinist, and they had a group called the Hot Club of France. And they sort of imitated the big bands in America, the swing bands, Benny Goodman's and Duke Ellington's and the Count Basie. And they tried to do the same thing just with strings. And Django was a very vibrant player, and he was handicapped. He had two fingers. His first two fingers were the only fingers that moved on the instrument.
I always find that so remarkable.
And he played sort of an acoustic sound. And later on, when he appeared with... Duke Ellington here in the States. He played electric. But his most famous song, I'll play one quick chorus for you, and then I'll show you how he played. This is the song he wrote. It's called Nuage. Thank you. string style that he was famous for.
Yeah, one of the things that's really interesting about you is that you've played, you know, demonstrating Django Reinhardt. He played with Stefan Grappelli. So did you. Eddie Lang, the great guitarist, influenced you. He played with Joe Venuti. So did you. Charlie Christian, the great jazz guitarist, played with Benny Goodman. You eventually played with Goodman. So did you always feel like you had to really play in the styles of the guitarists who had preceded you in those groups?
Well, when I was in going to high school, I used to listen to all those records. And we didn't have many records to go by, but it was mostly radio shows that we listened to, and we often caught Charlie Christian with Benny Goodman from one of the hotels here in New York,
yeah.
and the same thing, a few records of Charlie Christian that he made, Charlie's made with the Sextet, and also Django Reinhardt with Hot Club.
What does Charlie Christian do for you?
Charlie played a more swinging single string style that imitated a tenor saxophone, and he didn't play quarterly at all. He just played single notes, but he played in the style of a Lester Young playing straight eighth notes. He made a great record with Benny Goodman called Solo Flight, and he played like
that style a lot in your own playing?
Oh, yeah. I steal from the best.
Yeah. What did you steal from Eddie Lang?
Well, Eddie Lang played a chordal style. He played fill-ins behind Benny Goodman,
Joe Venuti.
No, Bing Crosby.
Oh, yeah.
And they were known, you know, whenever you heard Bing Crosby on the radio, there was always a guitar playing without the amplifier, and he was playing fill-ins. That's all you heard him noodling all through the records. And his famous record is a tune called Please. And all you hear throughout the record is Eddie Lang playing that beautiful guitar style.
And Carl Kress.
Carl Kress was teamed with another guitarist here in New York, and they were known for playing many radio shows. They did like 30 shows a week not too far from here, and they played practically every show that was to be played in New York City.
Is there a particular style of his?
Yes, they had a great style, and they just for laughs, they would get together and go to a studio and make records. And the nice thing about Carl Kress was that he was one of the most musical of all the guitarists, because they played romantic music. They listened to classical music constantly, and then it came out in their jazz, and they would also play humorous music, frisky music, and they would play swing, and they would do everything together. And they had some kooky little pieces that they played. Some were called Chicken a la Swing. One was called, it went like... you know, little razzmatazz kind of songs like that. But then he also wrote some nice pieces, one called Love Song. That's called Love Song. And then he did a kooky one called Peg Leg Shuffle.
That's great.
Little things like that.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest is Bucky Pizzarelli, and we're going to have you put all of this together, all the little things you demonstrated for us, in one tune that you're going to play after we take a short break. And I should mention, Bucky Pizzarelli has a new album called A Portrait. It's on Stash Records. Back in just 60 seconds, this is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Chrysler Corporation earnings are up, and possibly consumer confidence around the country as well. I'll talk with David Kay, a former weapons inspector in Iraq, who says the time for patience and compromise is over in Iraq. It's time now to take military action against the Saddam Hussein regime. Also, a new mammal species may have been discovered in a remote part of Vietnam, a forest preserve there. It's sort of a forest goat, also some brand new birds, and a yellow tortoise.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Bucky Pizzarelli is joining us live with his guitar. And Bucky, you've demonstrated for us like different historical styles that you've learned over the years. Let's put it all together. Play something your own. You know, the composition isn't your own, but the style is. And I think we'll hear maybe a lot of the things that you've been pointing out in the past few minutes.
Okay, I'd like to do Satin Doll.
I guess that about sums it up. Yeah. That was wonderful. You know, you've had such an interesting career, just playing with all the jazz musicians, doing all the studio work. I mean, I can't believe you were on sessions with Dion and the Belmonts. Was that were you into the music, or was it just a gig?
No,
you show
really,
up,
I learned
play
a lot from a lot of those people. You know, because in those days, mostly everybody was trying to play jazz gigs or play with dance bands, and dance bands were just fading then, and everybody was migrating back to New York, and if you owned a guitar, they put you on a rock and roll date, you know, and a lot of people don't know that some of the best jazz guitar players are on the best rock and roll dates.
Yeah, Barney Kessel's on a lot of them,
oh, everybody.
Too. Yeah,
George Barnes, Tony Mottola, and Mondell Lowe. We all did sessions every day, and we never had the kind of guitars that the kids are buying today to play those sessions. We had all jazz guitars.
You know, I put on Teenager in Love to see if I could hear you, and I heard it sounded like a banjo.
Oh, here we go. Hey, that's but all those dates were more or less faked. One, we would have three or four guitar players, and one would go. Another guy would go.
Do you miss those days when there was a lot of studio work? Because it isn't like that anymore.
No, well, I didn't like it because it got the music, you know, we only played three chords. You know, you do that all year, drive right. You up the walls.
Oh, gosh. In the 2 seconds we have left, how'd you get the nickname Bucky? Who gave it to you?
Oh, my father gave me that name. Uh-huh. He went to Texas when he was young, and when he came back, he had to name somebody after a cowboy, I guess.
And you were the one. All right. Well, this has been a great pleasure. Just really fun. Thanks
Thank
so much for being with
us. Oh, it's good to do live radio.
Yeah, isn't it great? Yeah. The great jazz guitarist, Bucky Pizzarilli. And I should say, he has a new album, too. It's called Bucky Pizzarilli, A Portrait. It's on Stash Records. And Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. But today we're live from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. And with us today throughout the show has been the composer of the Fresh Air theme, Joel Forrester. I'd like to bring the two great musicians in the room together now and ask you both to play us out. And before I do, I'll just say I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air. And I thank our studio audience for being with us. Take it away.
1, 2, 3.
And while they play, I have some people to thank for today's show. Today's edition of Fresh Air was live from the broadcast studios of the Museum of Television and Radio in Midtown Manhattan. Our thanks to Ken Mueller, Chris Catanese, Bill Beam, Robert Baccia, and the rest of the museum staff, and Mark Vogelzang, Kathy Ball, and Art Ellis at WHYY-FM. The Fresh Air crew is Danny Miller, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Joan Tuohy. Our floor director, Sue Spolin. Roberta Shurrock directed the broadcast. Our technical directors are Orji Voblaitis and Ron Barron. I'm Terry Gross.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we're live again from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York. Guy Klusevic will bring his accordion to play polkas from the fringe. And Anna Deavere Smith will perform excerpts of her acclaimed one-woman show about racial and ethnic identity. It's now running at the Public Theater in New York. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Here on 91 FM, WHYY FM, Philadelphia.